Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Dr. John Toros, co-director of the Digital Psychiatry Program at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you on. I've certainly enjoyed talking with you in the past, so happy to be able to bring a new aspect to the show. But before we dive in, would you mind giving everybody a little bit of a fuller introduction as to who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I said, my name is John Torres. I'm a physician. I'm a psychiatrist here in Boston at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, one of the Harvard affiliate hospitals. My background, though, is actually in electrical engineering and computer sciences at UC Berkeley. I went to medical school at UC San Diego. I'm now also a clinical informatics fellow here at Harvard Medical School. And I do a lot of work at the intersection of mobile technology like smartphones and sensors and mental health.
So what brought you into medicine coming from an electrical engineering background?
You know, electrical engineering was a lot of fun, but there was one night where I was programming probably at 2 or 3 a.m., getting some code to work, and I said, I don't think I want my whole life to be programming a computer. I love science, but I really want to work with people, and healthcare seemed like the right path of science and people together.
Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting, and it seems like very timely given the shift that medicine is trying to take into a more digitally focused and, digitally utilizing means of delivering care.
No, exactly. And I said, I think I applied to medical school, it was at least a decade ago, but I think certainly we've all seen that certainly the rise of digital medicine, digital healthcare, the interest is kind of just booming. And it's always been there. People have been working on these problems for many, many years. But I think the interest has really skyrocketed in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I think that's probably very accurate. I think meaningful use gets a lot of the attention, but as you say, kind of the skyrocketing interest, there's got to be something else driving it just than the money to get an EMR into place.
It's interesting too, at least of the EMRs, a lot of the initial high tech money actually didn't go to mental health. And mental health was kind of left out of the first wave of EMRs. If you look at the most recent government data, only about 60% of psychiatrists use an EMR. That was in 2015. Of all the major medical subspecialties, psychiatry is actually the lowest in terms of EHR utilization. Most fields are kind of in the high 80s or low 90s, but psychiatry is actually in 60%, so there's a long way to go in even getting psychiatry up on board with stuff that other fields are already using.
Yeah, and actually, that's a very good point, because as you were saying, you're a psychiatrist. So how do you see psychiatry and maybe mental health generally, how does it operate differently from physical medicine, if that's the appropriate distinction?
I think what's happened, I would argue, unfortunately, is in some ways, mental health has been kind of a little bit psychiatry and mental health have been a little bit removed from the rest of healthcare, and that sometimes your insurance plan will have a carve out for your mental health benefits, so it won't be at the same place. A lot of hospitals won't have, say, inpatient psychiatry units, places where people can stay overnight because those aren't as profitable. Those will be somewhere else. A lot of psychiatrists may not accept the insurance you have. It may only be cash out of network. So in some ways, it can be difficult in that the psychiatry system isn't as well integrated into the kind of main healthcare system that we all work with and experience. I think that's changing. There's a huge push in psychiatry, especially the American Psychiatric Association is leading to bring kind of integrated care to say really mental health and physical health are not different or closely related. We have really good evidence to show that mental health outcomes push physical health and vice versa. And you really need to kind of have the care shared together. We're moving towards that, but clearly there's a lot of fragmentation right now. And in some ways, that's an opportunity for digital health and digital psychiatry to help bridge that gap.
So your reference to digital health and digital psychiatry, can you kind of explain what those fields are in more detail from your perspective as a provider?
Of course. I said so. I think there's certainly words like digital psychiatry are very broad, at least how I think I and other people may be formulating it is that we're saying, you know, psychiatry does a really great job for the people we reach. We can help a lot of people. We can transform lives and improve outcomes. But we realize that we're not reaching everyone. There is an access problem. A lot of people can't access care. So digital psychiatry gives us a way to expand the reach and how psychiatrists can reach new people, new populations, bring high quality care to a larger group. Digital psychiatry also has the advantage of it can help us bring in new information that may be clinically relevant to psychiatry. So we can learn new things about our patients. We can have new sensors to help us monitor. We can make more informed decisions with patients together about what's going on. So digital psychiatry helps us push the reach of psychiatry, but also makes the field more informed by bringing in new information that we can use to make better decisions.
What form does that take? Is it a telehealth type platforms, mobile health apps? Kind of what do you utilize most frequently?
So I said, there's actually, of course, there's many different types of technology, many sensors. There's actually a very robust evidence base for telepsychiatry. Peter Yalalees at UC Davis is actually the president of the American Telemedicine Association this year. So a psychiatrist, he's leading the ATA this year. And the evidence and work he's done in showing that telepsychiatry works to improve outcomes and save costs is just fantastic. Here in Boston, our group is doing a lot of work with smartphones, so a newer technology. And what we're seeking to do is to learn if people install a smartphone app in a research context, so with informed consent, they understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, and they agree to it, can we collect sensors from their smartphones, such as pings of their GPS that may give us a clue to how far they've moved, if they've left the home, how many locations they've visited? Can we ping their accelerometer to figure out, are they sitting for most of the day? Are they moving? Are they running? Are they active? Can, again, with their permission, we learn about how social they are by looking at the metadata of their call and text logs? By metadata, I mean, we don't know who they called or what they said or what the conversation was. We know that, say, John made an outgoing call at 10 a.m. and it lasted for 2 minutes, and he had a missed call at 3 p.m. and it lasted, and he missed that call. And he sent 8 text messages. So can we, from the phones, learn a little bit about functional outcomes? How are people doing outside the clinic, outside the hospital, in the real world, by signals their phone is doing? So the phone probably has a good idea of how much I move around, how social I am, how many times I open it, how many times I close it. Even the battery, the phone may know, John actually charged me last night, I'm at 100%, or John forgot to charge me, and now I'm at 2%, and he's going to be running on fumes all day. So We're learning about those signals in the phone and what they can tell us.
I think that's was kind of anticipating the question I was going to ask is, what do you end up doing with the information? Or maybe even for the first point, you know, you just kind of mentioned all this metadata and other information you can collect from the phone. Like, how do you collect it, and then how is it brought in to be able to be actually utilized, as opposed to just getting this massive data that could overwhelm many people?
You know, that's a great question. I think it gets the point of, it's certainly easy to collect all this data in this day and age with the smartphones and sensors. And just the fact that you can collect it doesn't inherently make it clinically valuable or useful. We're lucky in Boston. I said, our collaborator is the Onella Lab at the Harvard School of Public Health. And Professor J.P. Onella there got a grant from the NIH to build a research smartphone app that collects all this raw data from the smartphones, called Biwi. And we've been using his Biwi platform to collect this data. And it's nice because I said it collects the raw data. It doesn't kind of cut off the data, try to do some, it doesn't, let's put it this way, if you and I make a telephone call, it sounds a little staticky and blurry because the telecoms cut out a lot of the data to make it easier to transmit our signal. When you're collecting the raw data, you have exactly the raw data. You have the raw accelerometer file, the raw voice file, the raw GPS. And that's useful for science because we can go back and look at the raw data. We can reanalyze it. There's no assumptions we're making. So with the Biwi platform, it collects the raw data and sends it to a secure server on the Harvard campus. And I said, what we do with that then is the Harvard School of Public Health and J.P. Onella's lab, it's a biostats lab. So we're working with the biostatisticians, and we're kind of learning together, what are the best methods to analyze this data? How do we do it in a reproducible way? I think machine learning has kind of become a buzzword, And if you substitute machine learning for magic, I think that's what people are saying a lot of time. We put the data in, magic, and results came out. And we probably don't want to be in the realm of magic when we're working with healthcare. You want to know why it worked, why it's reproducible, why you could trust it. If someone says, come to my hospital, we're going to do magic, it's going to be great, you may not want to go to that hospital. Likewise, if someone says, give me all your data, I'm going to do magic to it, it's going to be great, you may want to say, how do I know what you're doing is valid, reproducible? So we're taking a much more humble approach to this data and saying, let's have the methods we do. We're going to publish everything. We're going to show people, here's the methods, here's the assumptions, here's why we think it worked. But I think what we do is unique is we're going to say, you know, here's the BeWe app in 2018. It's going to be open access and public. Here's the methods. Use our tools, reproduce it. We want other people to see if they can match our results. If they can't, we'll learn together and make it better. But I think we're hoping to start a dialogue based on reproducible evidence-based science. So kind of moving away from, we claim we can do X and you should believe us. That's not where this field needs to go. We need to kind of have evidence-based discussions based on results. And I said, we'll learn together.
I think your statement of we can't do magic in healthcare is capturing, I don't know if it's a deficiency or just an oversight when it comes to these apps. Because I think, as you just said, that's, at least when I'm reading articles, seems to be the biggest issue of, okay, it's great that you say that this can do this, but you kind of have to open up that black box and make it understandable, because, you know, we're dealing with, as you said, an evidence-based field where you have to make it reproducible.
Exactly. And if you want, I mean, a lot of these apps, the reason perhaps you're not seeing them used in daily healthcare is a lot of these findings are exciting and they're real, but they're not reproducible yet, or things that work well once don't seem to work well twice. And that's certainly, we need things to work well all the time if we're going to be using them, especially in mental health, where issues can be, if we're using these for suicide detection, say suicide prevention, we want things that work more than once in a pilot study.
I think making it, taking the time to actually show that it can work in multiple instances is kind of, I hate to say it, but contrary to the popular way of wanting to do things, which is it works once, we found this, so now we have this great tool and let's rush it out there without taking the time to fully vet it. And as you said, make sure that people can do it time after time after time.
Exactly. I think we're seeing, though, we're especially in 2018, I think we're going to see more people beginning to appreciate that stance, just because the school of we did it once, it worked, it was cool, let's get it out there. No one has won of that. Entrepreneurs haven't won because no one's buying these apps. The healthcare system hasn't won because no one's using the apps. Patients haven't won because these things aren't improving outcomes. So I think kind of the proof is in the pudding, or we're seeing this old philosophy towards get it out there, build something cool, label as disruptive and innovative, and hope for the best hasn't really panned out for anyone.
Yeah, definitely. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Dr. John Torres from Beth Israel in Boston. We're talking digital health solutions and kind of the issues surrounding them. So, John, kind of turning back to the issue there that we've kind of been just talking about the reproducibility of data, and that the research that you're doing, that you want to make it open source. I don't know if this is controversial or not, to say or not, but I feel like I've seen a lot of criticism of scientific journals and maybe medical journals in particular about not making that background data public, and that there's a growing effort to make sure that things are reproducible. So is your focus on wanting to make it open source and, you know, pull back the curtain driven by that, or more the fact that this is how you've always viewed it and that it just kind of falls in line with the growing awareness that you actually do need to be able to prove out what you're saying?
You know, I think another very good point, and I'll say I edit one of these health tech journals called JMIR Mental Health. So I said, as editor, I see a lot of papers come across my desk. And I think what I've seen in that role, and certainly so as an editor of a healthcare journal and also as a researcher, is it's really hard to reproduce study findings. Because let's say you and I build our own app and we do a cool study and find a cool result. If I don't have access to that same app and the same tool that was done in a study, how can I reproduce it or build upon those results? So a lot of the trouble is that we're having a lot of interesting things that are being discovered, but because we're all measuring it different ways using different tools, it's hard for anyone to kind of come to consensus. It's almost like everyone's using a different microscope with a different lens, and seeing something a little bit different. So we know there's something there, but until we're all measuring using the same tools, it's going to be difficult. And I said, I don't think we've really seen much sharing of app tools or kind of the ways we're collecting the data in the literature. I said, I think people are kind of hiding their apps or not sharing them. Perhaps they're trying to commercialize them and sell them. But I imagine if you and I went to kind of some recent papers produced and said, can we please have your app for our own research? We would have trouble getting access to those apps and tools.
Yeah, no, and I think maybe this is a jaded point of view, but I think the supposition you made of, wanting to be able to commercialize it would seem like a driver, because I suspect that there'd be a lot of fear that if you share the tool or how you developed it and give it to someone else, then you're losing a lot of control, and that you could lose, and if it actually does provide the benefit that you think it does, you've maybe lost out on a money-making opportunity.
And I said, it's certainly a fear I can understand why people have. I would counter that it's, at least to date, I don't think any mental health app has kind of made anyone a millionaire that I'm aware of. And I said, that could be wrong. And I said, I stand to be corrected. But I think mental health has never been the field that has the most resources and most money in the history of healthcare. I think in the Middle Ages, often the church took care of people with mental health issues. Until recently, we had a huge state system with the state hospitals that had their own issues, but that was really the state was taking care of a lot of patients of chronic mental health issues. And I said, it's only in the last decade people have begun to say there's a lot of profit to be made in mental health. And I said, well, we'll see. The future will tell us if that's true or not.
Maybe to the point of you saying that there's, people are starting to see the profit opportunity, maybe that also connects back to an earlier point that you made about a growing sense that we need to require, and arguably starting to see, at the parity in terms of reimbursement by payers, and also just the fact that mental health really isn't necessarily a standalone, but you have to look at a comprehensive health of an individual. So there's all that interplay between both mental and physical health.
Exactly. And there actually is, the American Psychiatric Association has done a nice job lobbying for mental health parity and a nice job beginning to enforce it now. So it's one thing that we have mental health parity, and that legally insurance is have to offer parity in the services you get for physical and mental health. Sometimes it's not always enforced to the T. And I think we're also going to see in 2018 more efforts and more enforcement of mental health parity.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point, and kind of something that I'll see in my legal practice is, a distinction between parity of coverage and parity of payment. Because I think sometimes you've got laws that are more on the side of, you just have to make sure people can get to the services, not necessarily that the reimbursement has to be on par.
Exactly. And I think, part of the reason, especially that this app landscape, and let's call it digital psychiatry landscape, has become a little bit of the Wild West, is that there really are no standards. It's kind of all evolving. So I said, if mental health, we're still working on issues like parity, when these apps come along, they kind of live outside existing regulatory frameworks. I know you and I have written an article on certainly the legal consequences of app claims and who's actually monitoring app claims, who's legally responsible if apps cause harm. And a lot of times it lives in the gray area. I said, we know that the FDA has largely taken a hands-off approach to apps and kind of saying, if it looks low risk and it's not claiming to be a medical device, the FDA has jurisdiction over it, but probably isn't going to be evaluating it. It was interesting that about a month ago, the FDA did approve an app for mental health that deals with substance abuse. But if you actually look at what that approval meant, it was kind of a de novo pathway. So that app company basically said, we're better than any other app for mental health, which is none, and we don't cause side effects. It's hard for an app to kind of cause classic side effects like nausea or weight gain, et cetera, that mental health meds may have because it's an app. So it was almost that app company was the first to kind of get to FDA approval. But I think we're going to begin to see interesting changes in how these apps will be regulated moving forward. I know that, I work at the American Psychiatric Association, and we're working hard to not regulate apps. We're never going to say this app is a good or bad one, but to begin to have a framework that people, clinicians and patients can use to begin to make more informed decisions about apps. So instead of going to the iTunes or Android store and typing in depression and getting back a sea of apps, can we offer a framework and tool to guide people through informed decision making? So can we say, before you pick an app, have you checked that there's a privacy policy? Because a lot of these apps don't even offer basic things like a privacy policy that tells you what happens to your information. Have you checked that there's some evidence that this app is useful? Does this app look like something you can use for more than a day? Is it going to be engaging? And can the app make sure that you share data back of your clinical team, of the family members, or the people you want to share it with in a meaningful way? So on the APA website, psychiatry.org, under psychiatrists practice mental health apps, we actually have a nice resource, the first draft of it, of kind of a framework or scaffold that people can use to begin to make more informed decisions about apps. That said, we don't endorse, recommend, or kind of say you should use this app or not this app.
No, that's a great resource to be developing because, you know, as you're pointing out, it is really probably next to impossible for the average person and even probably very hard for you on, you know, working with the American Psychiatric Association to actually be able to sort through these apps and try and figure out which ones can actually do what they're claiming and which ones could potentially be beneficial. Again, certainly appreciating the fact that you said the association can't really, and it is not going to endorse any of the apps, but at least to help to sort out the ones that are clearly not going to be helpful.
Exactly. And, you know, there's some websites that say they do expert app evaluation, but the problem of apps is if you look at your smartphone now, I bet there's about 10 apps that want to update and change, or at least on my phone, there's 40 apps that want to update. You can imagine that even if we have an expert or kind of an expert committee endorse an app or stamp it as good, these apps update and change so much, they're a moving target, that it's really hard to kind of give a static score and say, this app is an A+, this is a B-, this is an 88 out of 100. And it's also, I said, you can imagine nothing in healthcare. If you go to a hospital and say, give me the A+ medication, people would kind of look at you and say, what? Or if you said, give me the A- imaging study, people would go, what does that even mean? It's so much of healthcare depends on context, on your needs as the patient, and on what the clinic can offer. So just like with apps, it's almost in some ways pointless to kind of say, these are the top 10 apps or these are expert reviews because it's changing so much and it depends on context. So I think the solution may be educating people, both clinicians, patients, the public, to make more informed decisions, to ask the smart questions.
Yeah, definitely. And I suspect that probably relates back to, you know, a point that you made a few minutes ago as well about the fact that, you know, even though the FDA could try and regulate these, they've, you know, I agree with you, taken definitely more of a hands-off approach for the most part. I think it goes into that point that you just made about that the apps are being constantly updated because it's not like when it gets released, that's the final product and it's perfect forever. It seems like every software now it gets released and maybe within hours, sometimes it feels like of it being released, you're already getting an update because it's, you know, a constantly evolving process. And yeah, certainly in the medical device field, since I do a lot on the security and privacy side, that's a big issue since you've got outdated systems that aren't being updated for fear of running afoul of regulatory approvals.
Exactly. It'll be interesting, like I said, for all to keep an eye on. The FDA has this new pilot for health apps where they're pre-approving some companies like Apple, and they're saying, we're going to try a pilot where we pre-approve you as a developer of apps and see how that works. So instead of focusing on the end product and every product that Apple, say, produces, say, we trust you, we trust the way you develop code, we trust the way you audit and regulate yourself. So I think that pilot just started of kind of this kind of a developer approval process. And I say it's only a pilot. I think there's only 9 companies selected. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops or how that experiment in app regulation works.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And it's, as with everything, it raises other questions. But unfortunately, as we're getting very close to the end of our time, you've already made a few statements about what you think might be happening in 2018. What do you think the kind of the mobile and digital health landscape will look like in, say, 5 years?
You know, I think it's going to look very different than today. I think it certainly will smartphones still be the predominant technology everyone has that we're developing? Will other technologies we haven't even quite realized seen, will things like AR and VR take off or will they actually be flops? I think it's hard to know. I think what we will see, though, is we begin to build a better, more robust scientific evidence. We'll begin to have better gold standards on really what works in digital psychiatry, what doesn't work. We'll begin to learn more about implementation. How do we make it actually work for real people? How does it actually work in real healthcare systems? So I think even if the technology is going to be hyper-variable, maybe we're using smartphones, maybe we're using these fancy new watches, maybe we're using new virtual reality headsets. I don't think that will matter as much. But I think as we learn about how do we make sure information we collect is valid and reliable, how do we translate treating and offering people interventions of technology is effective and safe, I think as we work on these broader questions, we're going to see that in 5 years, there's a really large role for kind of using these technologies in care. And I said, so I think the user interface and kind of will be the hypervariable part. It'll continue to change. But I think as we're developing a strong research evidence-based core and kind of the fundamentals of how this works, it'll be exciting to see how the field quickly evolves.
I think that is a very great point, which, as you said, the tech will be extremely variable. But if we can get it to be more evidence-based, that will help validate and demonstrate or, you know, be more translatable across whatever the technology might look like. But believe it or not, we're already out of time. So I want to thank my guest, Dr. Torres, for a great conversation today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking. I look forward to talking more later and tuning in. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.